Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Up today, the usual two segments. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the veteran tax journalist David K. Johnston on whether there's anything to that IRS scandal. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from veteran Japan journalist Richard Katz on Abenomics, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's scheme to revive their long stagnant economy with, well, we'll find out. Before that, a few words about austerity, a recurrent obsession on this show. A few weeks ago, we heard Mark Blyth make a comprehensive case against it. For now, I just want to make some fact-checking points. You frequently see it claimed among orthodox and conservative types that austerity is essentially a hoax because government spending just keeps going up. In the U.S., Republicans will say, "What cuts? Spending keeps rising." But with a growing economy, rising prices, and an increasing population, spending needs to rise just to maintain the existing level of services. So if spending increases are lower than that maintenance rate of increase, they amount to real cuts in services. That's not just my definition, it's the concept that the Congressional Budget Office works with, too. With the austerity programs we've seen in the periphery of Europe, the arguments have been a little different. Several right-wing bloggers and pundits have recently summoned what they call evidence to show that there's been no austerity over there on the periphery of the old world. How do they argue that there's been no austerity when there quite certainly has been? Easy, just present ludicrous measures. For example, show that government spending as a share of GDP hasn't gone down, or the tax share of GDP hasn't gone up. Or even more egregiously, show that spending in nominal euros, unadjusted for inflation, has risen or is flat. Therefore, no cuts, QED. But in recessions, government spending usually rises thanks to things like unemployment insurance, and revenue falls because unemployed and broke people pay less in taxes. The honest way to evaluate fiscal policy over time is by adjusting for the state of the business cycle. That is, what would the current structure of revenue and spending look like if the economy were at some approximation of full employment? This allows you to isolate the active effects of policy and separate them from passive changes in revenue and spending that simply reflect ups and downs in the economic cycle. If you do that, you see profound swings towards austerity among the so-called PIGs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Since austerity took hold around 2009, those countries on average have tightened their fiscal policy by the structural measure I just described by almost 8% of GDP despite their collapsing economies. These numbers, by the way, come from the International Monetary Fund, not a bastion of pinko economics. That 8% tightening is a punishing number, more than twice what we've experienced in the U.S. since the initial Obama stimulus program started petering out a few years ago, and cuts have become the order of the day. Cuts in the order of 8% would be enough to induce a deep recession on their own. Occurring in the midst of an already deep recession, they deepen and lengthen it. So a consumer warning. If anyone tries to convince you that there's been no austerity in peripheral Europe, you can safely conclude that they're a hack, a liar, or a dupe. First up, David K. Johnston. Johnston, a frequent Behind the News guest, has been a journalist for a long time with a specialty in taxes. From 1995 to 2008, he covered that beat for the New York Times. He's now a columnist for Tax Analysts, a trade publication, and for the Columbia Journalism Review. He's also the author of several books, most recently The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind, which was published last year. There's no one better to comment on whether this scandal, an alleged IRS political vendetta against Tea Party-ish groups, is, in fact, a scandal. David K. Johnston. Welcome, David. To listen to some Republicans, this is worse than Watergate. To listen to some Democrats, it's entirely justified because the Tea Party was engaging in electoral politics. And what's the big fuss about? What's your opinion?
Well, Congress has set up rules, and those rules say that if you ask the IRS for the privilege of tax exemption for an exclusively social welfare organization, you have to be investigated. So that's like in the case of the Republicans saying that when someone commits a crime, you're not supposed to look at them. When someone applies for a building permit, you're supposed to just approve it without making sure the building is safe.
But I think some people would say that the Tea Party was singled out for ideological reasons, not just for technical compliance with the law.
Well, there's no evidence at all that the people in Tea Party, Glenn Beck's 912, Patriot Constitutional Education Organizations were picked out for foul reasons. It is absolutely improper to select people based on their name. It is no different than the police stopping young men and frisking them because of the color of their skin, which we know from the trial in New York is a practice of the New York Police Department and, of course, police departments all over the country. What happened here is wrong. It's unquestionably wrong. But that does not mean that it was motivated for bad reasons. The commissioner of the IRS, when this took place, was an appointee of George W. Bush. The inspector general, who has written a lengthy, detailed report on this, and I read every one of his audits, and he's very good, found no rot, no political motivation, no outside interference, no involvement outside of the Internal Revenue Service. So what happened here? In 1913, Congress passed a law that said you could create a social welfare organization, an organization to promote social welfare, and under the current law called Section 501c4, you must operate exclusively to promote social welfare, and the law says specifically, and it's all over the IRS website, that elections are not social welfare. Here's where the problems come in. In 1959, the IRS adopted a regulation to implement this law. Every law has an implementing regulation by the agency that must administer it. In that regulation, it said an organization exclusively devoted to social welfare is exclusively devoted to social welfare if it primarily promotes social welfare. Now, is there any person in America who's ever been in a romantic relationship who doesn't understand the difference between exclusively and primarily? And the reason they put in this regulation, we believe, and no one's been able to turn up the detailed records of this yet, they probably don't exist, is that various social welfare groups wanted an assurance that they could go to government to try and promote their causes. So imagine that you're a group promoting bicycle riding. You want students to ride bicycles to school and people to ride bicycles to work and people to ride bicycles for recreation because it's good for their health and reduces automobile traffic. Can you go to your city council and ask them to adopt policies and build streets in a way that promote bicycle riding? That's what they were trying to achieve. And it was understood, and I knew this when I first started looking at these issues in 1980, that the idea was you could spend a small amount of your money. I've since been told by people in the field it was understood to be 10%. I've had one person tell me 15% of your money to promote your cause. But you specifically could not be involved in partisan political activity, and you couldn't be involved in elections. Now jump forward to 2010. The U.S. Supreme Court, on a 5-4 vote, passes Citizens United. It grants, through court action, political rights to artificial persons, corporations, labor unions, and nonprofits. And so those organizations that wanted to be involved in partisan political activity but not reveal publicly who their donors were said, oh, instead of being what's called a 527 organization, which has to report its donors to the Federal Election Commission and identify them by name, we'll become a 501c4 social welfare organization where we only have to tell the Internal Revenue Service who our donors are, and it's never made public. And as a result of that, you have Crossroads GPS, founded by Karl Rove, which raises tens of millions of dollars a year, and whose tax return, because nonprofit tax returns are public, shows that it spent 99.9% of its revenue in 2011 on political activity and literally 0.1% promoting social welfare through a grant they made that they called social welfare. I don't even know that that grant actually promotes social welfare.
Just a question before you go on. What's the difference between a 501c3 and a C4?
A 501c3 is what we think of as a charity. It's a group to which you can make a tax-deductible contribution. Donations to 501c4s are not deductible. They are not charities. They're nonprofits, but they are not charities. They are not relieving the government of a burden the way a charity does, or at least the law assumes that it does. So you can give money to your church, the school that you went to, a nonprofit hospital, the United Way, your local community foundation. That's deductible as a 501c3.
All right, back to that social uplifter, Karl Rove.
So Rove comes along and sees this opportunity to become a 501c4, and then he doesn't have to reveal to the world who his backers are. The amounts of money, yes, the names of the donors know. Now, Rove is not alone in doing this. Bill Burton, former Obama White House person, has a progressive group. There are a bunch of progressive groups. So now put yourself in the position of being an employee in the IRS determination unit. People seek from you a determination. Do we qualify under Section 501c4 as an organization exclusively devoted to social welfare? And you write in your application, what activities are you going to be doing? Well, we're going to be holding candidate forums. We're going to be trying to elect free market advocates to office. We're going to try and change the laws in this country through legislative changes. Well, those kinds of words invite inquiry. And the IRS, if you apply, is required, therefore, to check these out. By the way, you don't have to apply. It appears, as best we can tell, they won't answer the question, that Karl Rove's group took advantage of simply self-declaring. You can just declare that you're a 501c4. If you then file your tax return, called a 990, unless you're audited and found to be unfit, you just operate as a 501c4.
Now you have to jump through more hoops to be a C3, right?
Oh, to be a C3, you absolutely have to have what's called a determination letter, and any charity that ever asks you for money, by law, if you say, I want to see your determination letter, they have to show it to you. And any 501c3 engaged in any political activity loses its tax-exempt status if the IRS takes an enforcement action against them. So these folks applied. They filled out applications in a way that screamed, take a look at me. And they were a minority of the groups selected. There were 300 applications that these IRS workers in Cincinnati set aside for deeper review. Of the 300, only 75 were Tea Party, Patriot, Glenn Beck's 912, constitutional education organizations. Now, there's another aspect of this, Doug, that's very important. Constitutional education is, to the IRS, often code for tax scams. There are a whole bunch of people out there saying no law requires you to pay taxes, even though the Constitution, in its very first grant of power from the people to Congress, says the Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, and imposts. They insist you don't have to pay. It's a voluntary system. Completely false. But if you say constitutional education to the IRS, it immediately raises eyebrows because of the history. So you could be pure as the driven snow, but you're reasonably going to be looked at in the same suspicious way that somebody who walks into a bodega with a mask on is going to be assumed to be a bandit. The Patriot groups, they would tend to arise suspicion because the IRS has been the subject of repeated violent attacks, bombings, shootings, things sent in the mail, including a live snake in one case. And Patriot, many groups that call themselves Patriot, you can find them on the internet, will tell you the IRS is, in their view, a criminal organization. So that's not surprising. And what about Glenn Beck's 912? Which, by the way, his website, The Blaze, says it's not Glenn Beck's 912. I'll leave that to people to judge for themselves. The law also says in 501c4 that an individual cannot be the beneficiary of the organization. This is for public benefit, not private benefit. And I think since Glenn Beck started it, 912, when he was on Fox, he has used it to promote his internet program and other activities. Reasonably, someone would raise the question, is this really for social welfare promotion or is it for Glenn Beck promotion? Now, it may not be for Glenn Beck promotion, but I would expect the IRS to investigate that.
Are there any comparable organizations on the broadly conceived political left, or is this kind of thing seen more on the right, which is what would provoke disproportionate interest from the IRS?
There are a number of progressive, liberal, lefty, Democratic-connected organizations that are 501c4s, and the only ones I've been able to find who have had their status revoked by the IRS are liberal, left, Democratic organizations. There was an organization set up, for example, to train women to become leaders in the Democratic Party. That was held, and held correctly, to not qualify as a 501c4. Their status was revoked, and they went out of business. So the idea that this is targeted at the Republican groups is absurd, but that doesn't take away the fact that it is wrong. It is indefensible and wrong to pick a group based alone on its name. And the IRS management recognized this. they said, don't do it that way. They then changed the manager in the office, and somehow the message either didn't get through or got contravened. That's one of the things we don't understand exactly what happened here. But the inspector general, a Republican appointee, a former Bob Dole aide, a Republican operative in the past, he has said to Congress and in his report, not done outside the IRS, no evidence done for partisan reasons, no evidence done for any reason other than the IRS workers trying to deal with this conflict between the exclusively language of the statute and the primarily language of the regulation.
I'm speaking with the prolific and accomplished tax journalist David K. Johnston. What do you make of the administration's response so far?
Well, I think that the administration has tried so hard to distance itself from this that they've perhaps made it worse. The president came on a national television to announce that the Treasury Secretary had fired the head of the IRS, who had nothing to do with this. He was an acting commissioner. He's been in office for a few months. He came along after the fact, had nothing to do with this. They have subsequently accepted the resignation of the guy who, the deputy commissioner for tax-exempt organizations, who likewise had nothing to do with this. He's been in the job, I think, 10 days. Now, both of these men, as the right is pointing out, were about to retire anyway. Nonetheless, getting fired on national television when every network, you know, presented this as it happened live is pretty traumatic. He fell on his sword, however, and he's out of there. It's the prior commissioner, George W. Bush's commissioner, who's important to this, and he will be testifying to Congress about this probably more than once before all of this is over. He has said that he was minimally aware of what was going on and that all of this was way down in the weeds, which is exactly the case. Now, I have read news articles quoting Tea Party people and conservatives as saying, well, I was targeted for an audit. I was audited after I spoke up. We conduct 1 million audits a year in this country, not nearly enough. And if you're a very high-income person, if you make over $1 million a year, you have about a 16% chance, that's 1 in 6, of being audited. That means that lots and lots of people who didn't speak up were audited. Lots and lots of people who are liberals were audited. It is absurd to suggest that there's a connection absent any other evidence, and yet the Wall Street Journal, which used to be a really great newspaper, a very ethical newspaper, a very carefully, thoroughly reported newspaper, immediately ran with a Peggy Noonan piece on this. And, of course, Peggy Noonan is a political operative, and she was writing on the editorial page. But the news pages of the journal have further reinforced this idea that there's something foul going on here when there is, to this point, no evidence whatsoever of it.
And the office that reviews these nonprofits, it sounded like kind of a backwater, understaffed, underfunded. Is that a correct impression?
Well, much as probably nobody who can get a job elsewhere really wants to work for the IRS, the real backwater shop of the IRS is the determination unit. You know, there's no bureaucratic advancement and promotion now from the determination unit. You're basically getting 60,000 organizations a year saying, please determine that I am one of the 501c organizations. There are 25 categories of 501c, some of which are actually businesses. You can operate some businesses as a nonprofit, small insurance companies. And in my book, Perfectly Legal, 9 years ago, I told about a Wall Street guy who created a little tiny insurance company with no more than $64,000 a year of revenue and earned a $500 million tax-free profit.
More broadly, the issue of IRS funding, it does sound like there's been quite a conscious effort to underfund the thing. Is that a correct impression?
Yes. In real terms, the IRS is 17% smaller today than it was a decade ago. That's when you adjust for the growing population of the country and for inflation, a 17% reduction. And there's an analogy here to Benghazi. You know, the same Republicans on the right who are trying to stir up the hatred of the IRS and the government and therefore the Obama administration also cut spending severely for security for our diplomats. And Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, pleaded for more money and was turned down. And then the Republicans say you didn't have any security. I mean, the chutzpah involved in that is astonishing. Now, the solution to this, however, is not necessarily to spend more money. I write a column for Tax Analysts. That's a nonprofit organization that publishes about 250 pages of tax journalism a week, international, federal, and state. And my column this week is called Solving a Scandal with 8 Words. All we have to do is add 8 words to the law, and this problem would go away. And those 8 words are, after they describe social welfare organizations as exclusively promoting social welfare, comma, and which are barred from political activity, comma.
Would they litigate what political activity is, then?
Well, perhaps, and certainly, you know, people who are actually drafters of statutes could do a better job than I did as a journalist who writes about these issues. But my point is that a structural fix here is very simple. As I said earlier, you know, is there any grown-up who doesn't understand what exclusive means in a romantic relationship? Well, the same thing applies to social welfare organizations. Social welfare group that's promoting bike lanes or flowers in the park or youth sports ought to be able to go to the city council, the county legislature, the state legislature, or Congress to plead for its cause. But they should not be able to spend any money that either directly says, elect this guy or don't elect that guy, or that is focused on trying to get people to go to a partisan or a candidate-centered activity. You should be required to stick to promoting your cause and to only spend a minority of your money on that.
I was really asking about the general issue of IRS funding for more, you know, broad compliance and enforcement on personal and corporate accounts.
Why would the anti-tax Republicans, or in fact anybody running for office on the basis that government is bad, want to put more money into the IRS? Frank Luntz, the brilliant pollster who works for the Republicans, but who, you know, could have worked for the Democrats just as well, he just happened to end up with the Republicans, he has taught them, and I wrote in my book Perfectly Legal about how he showed them that the simplest, easiest, best way to raise campaign money and get votes is to attack the IRS. And, you know, we have people out there saying, let's get rid of the IRS. There is no government in the world that has ever operated without a tax system. The great conservative Edmund Burke in 1793 said, the revenue of the state is the state. We have to have a tax agency. What we don't have to have is a tax code that's becoming more and more bloated because of favors handed out by anti-tax politicians to their friends that allow people who are not wage earners and not pensioners to earn income but not pay taxes on it. And that's what the real game is here. It's for investors, business owners, particularly people who operate on a worldwide basis, not just a domestic basis, to be able to earn income that is blind to the tax system. So when the IRS is cut, those people who work for a salary or get a pension, they are not affected. The taxes they owe are taken out of their checks before they get them, and the system is automated, and there are virtually no opportunities to cheat. You can claim you paid more in property taxes than you did. You can claim you paid more and gave more to charity than you did. That's about it. The rest of the system is pretty tight. If you, however, run a little business, whether you're a landscaper or you're a giant worldwide corporation run by one person, and there are such things out there, you have all sorts of opportunities to cheat. And if you are, by the way, a big company now, the Republicans got rules put in that say that the IRS has to, when it audits you, it selects you for an audit, they have to tell you in advance what they're going to look for, and they can't look anywhere else. So when the auditors come in, if they find something, could be massive cheating, they are prohibited from pursuing it. Now imagine that. I mean, think about if we had that rule for nursing homes. We're going to have nursing home inspections. We're going to call you ahead of time to see if there are people with bed sores and filthy sheets and flies. And, oh, we'll come by in 2 weeks. You got plenty of time to clean up and put on a show. This is a fundamentally corrupted system now. And in the same way, we are corrupting the system with 501c4s by allowing them to engage in political activity rather than simply advocate for their cause.
Finally, since I have you here, what about this Apple investigation? It seems like Apple is certainly not alone in doing it. I think Google does very similar things. So what do you make of it?
Well, the scandal in Apple is that what they're doing is perfectly legal. Always the scandal is the law and what the law allows. Apple has figured out how to get what's called stateless income. If you have income that is not attributable to any government anywhere, any jurisdiction, whether it's even the Cayman Islands or the United States, you don't have to pay taxes on it. and they have created all of these structures that allow them to create stateless income, and therefore they're not paying taxes on it. I have said we need to have a serious debate about whether to end the corporate income tax. Now, doing that would provoke, I believe, serious review of why we do or do not want to have a corporate income tax and the rules that would be needed if we got rid of it. And if we got rid of the corporate income tax, every other major country would probably do the same thing. That's why the rules are really important. But the real game in Washington now is to press for lower tax rates while keeping the same system where you can do what Apple's doing. And here's what Apple fundamentally does. It earns profits in the U.S. from products sold here, and it takes those profits and says, oh, the logo for Apple, we're going to put that in some offshore jurisdiction. And every time someone buys an Apple phone, an Apple computer, I'm an Apple customer, by the way, we will pay a royalty from our American pocket to our offshore pocket, and they convert that profit into a tax-deductible expense. And they pay no taxes on that money so long as they keep the money offshore. That's why they've got, I believe at last count, it was over $140 billion offshore and in cash. And Congress needs to fix that system. That's what Senator Levin, as he's finishing out his last term, is trying to get us to focus on, something I've been hammering away at for many years. It is totally unfair to domestic businesses. If you run a purely domestic business, you can't do these things, and the big multinational companies are eating your lunch. Little fact to keep in mind. There are 6 million corporations in America, 6 million. More than 80% of the assets are owned by just 2,600 of them. They're the ones with the lobbyists who are in there mining the public treasury, getting the rules written that make it legal for them to engage in this kind of behavior.
That was David K. Johnston, who knows more about taxes than any other journalist around. He's a columnist for Tax Analysts, a trade publication, and for the Columbia Journalism Review. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break.
Let me tell you how it will be. That's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
Have a son of Taxman, number 2 on National Review's list of the 50 greatest conservative rock songs of all time. That's not the original by the You Know Who's, that was by the Music Machine. Next up, Japan. The Japanese economy has been stagnant for the last 20 years, ever since the long wave of rapid growth from the 1950s through the late 1980s came crashing to an end in the early 1990s. Last December, Shinzo Abe took office as Prime Minister, promising a fresh policy approach to end the stagnation that's been dubbed Abenomics. It's his second stint as Prime Minister, widely perceived as a failure. He lasted exactly a year in office in 2006 and 2007. Maybe the second time will be the charm. Here's Richard Katz, Editor-in-Chief of the Oriental Economist Report. He's been covering that country's economy for 30 years. Richard Katz. Welcome, Richard. Before we get to the topic of Abenomics, what is your analysis of why the Japanese economy has been is stuck in the mud for the last 20 years?
There are two problems. One is on the demand side of the economy, and the other is on the supply side of the economy. So the supply side tells you how fast can an economy grow if it's got full employment, full use of capacity. Now, that's, you know, how if your labor force is growing at 1% a year, and output per worker is growing 2% a year, then you can grow 3% a year. In Japan, the population, the working age population, is actually shrinking. So the only source of GDP growth is productivity growth. And the productivity growth in Japan is pretty mediocre. And that's because there are an awful lot of anti-competitive activities within the business world, which really means companies don't have to be lean and mean, don't have to be productive. They can get away with it. Whereas the exporting companies like Toyota and companies like that are superb, but companies that only face the domestic market are really backward by international standards. The second issue is a demand thing, which is that the household share of national income is really low compared to other countries. And as a result, consumer spending is low. It's not low because people are too anxious to spend or too worried to spend or because of deflation. If people had more income, they spend more. In fact, their savings have actually gone down as they try to keep up spending in the face of falling or stagnant real wages. So that means that Japan's got to rely upon a big trade surplus or big budget deficits to make up for this lack of domestic private demand. And that causes all kinds of problems. And these are problems that people pointed out 25 years ago, but the solutions were not accepted.
Well, let's go back 25 years. At the end of in the 80s, during the boom years, it looked like Japan could do no wrong. It was going to take over the world, and they were going to send us the bill for it. Were we wrong then? Where did things go awry?
Yeah, we were wrong then. We were wrong then in the same way that we were wrong about the Soviet Union, that we viewed it because it had these nuclear missiles as a superpower, where in fact it was really a third world economy that just happened to have nuclear teeth. And similarly, we took from the examples of Toyota and Sony the way Sony used to be and projected that image onto the entire Japanese economy, where it's really there are two Japans. There's the international Japan, Canon, Toyota, companies like that, which, because they faced international competition, had to either improve or die. So like Panasonic and Sharper have that exposure, and they're in trouble because they haven't improved. But the domestic firms, which is 80% of the economy that treats the domestic market, they're not exposed to that pressure. So they can go on doing the wrong things for quite a long time. So it's not that something went wrong then. Something went wrong earlier. They were a superb economy in the 50s and 60s when they were catching up to the rest of the world. But once they became mature in the 70s, they had to change the way they were operating. They failed to change. And the metaphor I use, it's like the butterfly thinks it's still the caterpillar and won't leave the cocoon.
The bubble, of course, made things look really magnificent to a lot of, Japanese as well as outsiders.
Fact, if you do a literature search, it was not called the bubble until after it popped.
Just kind of the last stage of the post-World War II boom and that was disguising a lot of underlying troubles?
It was because they're in the face of these troubles, they tried to do, in a sense, what they're trying to do now, which is pump a lot of money into the economy and think that can overcome structural problems. You do need easy money as one ingredient for the solution, but it's like you've got a car with a broken engine and you're trying to pump more and more gasoline into the car. Well, no matter how much gasoline you put in, it's not going to go very well. So you can produce an artificial euphoria in the financial markets. And so you had stock prices going way up and housing prices going way up. And then people start building homes, not because there are customers to buy them, but because they could sell them like poker chips for even more than it costs to make them. But that boom can go on for several years, but not indefinitely. And so it was really the last gasp of a dying system.
At first, a lot of people thought that the problems of the Japanese economy was just the hangover of a burst bubble, a lot of bad debts, a lot of disappointed expectations. What was the contribution of that versus the what we might call more real sector events?
Well, I think the bubble itself was a symptom of a problem. It was a false answer to a real problem, let's say trying to pump in money. But this is a symptom that creates its own problems. So it ended up leaving the country with an awful lot of bad debt that people borrowed to build things that weren't worth what it cost to build them. And so it made things a lot worse, very similar to, say, the housing crisis in the United States, although far, far more severe. And so when you have that kind of a real estate or bubble, then you get several years of really subpar performances we're seeing in the United States. But usually that's about 5, 6, 7 years at most. You don't get 20 years of stagnation from a property bubble. So it was part of the problem, but I would say a secondary part of the problem.
And to return to the demand problem, why are Japanese household incomes so low?
Well, the markets don't really work properly in Japan. We think that, you know, we tend to think that markets solve things, and they do solve a lot of problems, but only if they're allowed to work properly. And even then, they need regulation and such. But the labor unions are very, very weak in Japan, so their bargaining power is very poor, which is a problem we're facing in the United States. The corporate sector, you know, you don't have strong capital markets, so corporations pile up this cash, excess cash in their vaults. The corporations are net savers to the tune of 5 or 6 or 7% of GDP, which either they invest overseas or they invest in financial investments rather than really pumping it back into the economy. They've had low interest rates for you know, 15 years. So a lot of the seniors who rely upon that as a big part of their income are not getting income. So it's a combination of things, but really it's a matter of the political power of the corporate sector vis-a-vis both the labor, the working class in Japan, but also, actually I shouldn't say working class since that's a pejorative term here, versus the labor force in Japan, let's put it that way. So it's a problem of the bargaining power of the corporate sector compared to the labor force, but also the corporate sector compared to capital markets and household savers and other and shareholders. These corporations can be an empire unto themselves.
Back in the 80s, I remember a lot of people admired the Japanese system of corporate governance, all the cross holdings and the relatively minor role for the stock market in setting corporate policy. First of all, were people wrong about that? And second of all, have things changed very much in that area?
You know, when something is succeeding, people look for a reason. And so they take what exists and they say, oh, well, this exists, therefore this must be a cause. So corporate governance. It's very interesting. If you read stuff from a century ago when Japan was performing very poorly, people would talk about how lazy the Japanese were because this is part of Confucian culture. And when they were succeeding, they said, look how hard they work, and this is part of Confucian culture. So people take an effect and then try to find a cause when the cause isn't there. Their corporate governance is a problem. It's not improved. But I want to caution that U.S. corporate governance is no better. In fact, in many ways, U.S. corporate governance is worse, as we saw in the Lehman shock, the subprime malfeasance that led up to that, Enron, and MCI. So I don't think American system of corporate governance is a model for Japan. And even, you know, this thing with Jamie Dimon, that they would not separate. It used to be that the chairman of the board, we start again, this Jamie Dimon thing at Morgan. It used to be in America that the chairman of the board was different from the CEO, and the job of the chairman of the board was to represent the stockholders and keep a tight rein on the CEO. Now it's the same person, and the CEO appoints his cronies. So I don't think America has anything to brag about in terms of corporate governance relative to Japan. It's a problem in both countries.
I'm speaking with Richard Katz, editor-in-chief of the Oriental Economist Report. Okay, and now on to the current Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe. First of all, where'd he come from? What's his story?
Well, Shinzo Abe is, like many Japanese leaders, particularly in the party that's governed the country for almost the entire period since World War II, he's the heir of previous politicians. His grandfather was a man named Kishi, who was very much involved in the 1930s, takeover of China. He sat for 3 years in prison as an unindicted Class A war criminal. And then when the Cold War began, the U.S. released a lot of them, so he was never indicted, let alone convicted. Abe's father was foreign minister and had considered to become prime minister. But his real hero is Kishi, who was really quite a nationalist. And that explains a lot of why Abe simply cannot get himself to admit that Japan committed aggression in World War II, because that was his grandfather who did it. His predecessor was the son of, was a descendant of a grandson of another prime minister, and also his father owned a coal mine that used slave labor during World War II. So, you know, it's and the prime minister before him was, in the LDP prime minister before him, was the son of a prime minister. So these, you really have a situation where, particularly in the Liberal Democratic Party, where the leadership are the descendants of previous leaders. So it's as if we only had Al Gore's and George Bush's and such as presidents.
We seem to be getting that way, though.
Well, that's a whole other, that's another interview. By the other hand, you think of Obama. Obama was a nobody, right? Bill Clinton was a nobody. Nixon was a nobody. Jimmy Carter was a nobody. Reagan was a nobody. We have people who rise from being nobodies to becoming president of the United States. Very difficult to do so in Japan.
So he comes into office with a grand scheme to depart from previous economic policy that gets dubbed Abenomics. What's it about?
Well, you know what happened? When he goes in there the first time in 2006, 2007, he completely ignored the economy. And his emphasis was on things like making the education curriculum more patriotic and revising the Constitution. And while GDP numbers looked better, that was not really benefiting the ordinary people whose real wages were still falling. And people didn't feel the recovery. And so he ignored the economy, and he became more and more unpopular, and he paid the lesson. So in 2009, some politicians said to him, if you want to come back, he lost the election, he had to leave office. They said, you've got to be Mr. Economy. And this is not a man who knows a lot about economics. He's not considered the most intelligent of the leaders in the LDP. And so they got about five or six economists who are called reflationists, who really believe that the heart of Japan's problems was deflation, which in fact is very mild. It's more a symptom of a problem than a problem in itself. And that the main thing to do was to cure deflation by printing a lot of money and raising people's expectations that inflation would come back. And if you did that, then suddenly you turn this economy into a boom.
You sometimes hear that here, a lot of like liberals who think that the Fed should do more to create inflationary expectations and that somehow is going to revive things. Do you buy this idea, this mechanism?
In an economy that's already in inflation, inflationary expectations can work. But most liberals in the United States would say you need to combine inflation with fiscal stimulus as well. And that's what occurred in Obama's first year. But you don't really have liberals in America saying you should only do monetary stimulus. They're emphasizing monetary stimulus because the political gridlock in Washington means you can't do any more fiscal stimulus. In fact, they're going the other way. And therefore, the only game left in town is the monetary stimulus. Whereas the conservatives have been opposing both fiscal and monetary stimulus. So monetary stimulus is one ingredient of what they need. But, you know, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Abe talks about three arrows. One is monetary stimulus to defeat inflation. The second arrow is called fiscal stimulus. And the third arrow is growth policy, which is supposed to be all kinds of reforms to get the potential growth higher, that is the supply side. So the first two are supposed to deal with the demand side to get the economy back up to full potential. And the third is the supply side, the structural reform. Now, in fact, he's only got one arrow. He's got monetary stimulus. He did a package of fiscal stimulus for 1 year. But beginning next year, they're reversing, the arrow is reversing direction toward fiscal austerity. They're raising the consumption tax from 5% to 8% of sales. And then a year later, they're raising it to 10%. Plus, they want various sorts of spending limits. So the second arrow is more like a dart rather than an arrow, and it reverses direction if the finance ministry has its way, reverses direction a year from now.
Now, before we get to the third arrow, I recall they raised the consumption tax in the 90s to disastrous results. Have they not learned a lesson?
Well, you see, there you go. See, I agree with you that when they rates that it had disastrous results. It helped trigger the worst recession it had up until the most recent one. But the finance ministry argues it was not the consumption tax that caused that recession. Rather, it was problems in the Japanese banking system. It was the widespread financial crisis in Asia, and it was not the consumption tax. And therefore, if you look at the growth models that are being put out by the Bank of Japan and the finance ministry, they all assume that raising the consumption tax is going to have a negligible effect on real growth. And that's what they said back in 1997. They were wrong then. I think they're wrong now. Sure. But they don't admit that the point is they don't, when you say they didn't learn their lesson, they would disagree with you. They would say there's no lesson to be learned.
And then before we get to the third hour, why is the Ministry of Finance so hell-bent on budget balance? Is it just the usual Ministry of Finance thinking?
Anywhere, anytime, the finance ministry always wants to cut spending and raise taxes. They're very, very focused on trying to balance the budget. They think if you give the politicians money to spend, they're going to spend too much, which is partly true, which is one of the reasons it's very hard to raise taxes in Japan, even if you need them, because people don't trust the politicians to use them well. Same problem we have in the U.S.
The history of fiscal stimulus has not been very inspiring, has it?
Well, actually, in Japan, it worked when it was applied, but the problem was they did it in stop-go fashion. So they put their foot on the gas, and then to the brake, gas, brake, gas, brake, gas, brake. And so you didn't really have a sustained effort. And secondly, they spent it on really useless things, the famous bridges to nowhere. They would just spend gobs of money that were basically boondoggles for construction firms and politicians with kickbacks to build a bridge that hardly anybody used, where in fact there are tons of things that you could do that would be very, very worthwhile for Japan. For example, had they built a seawall around that nuclear power plant, as was recommended, we would not have had this disaster we had. There was another nuclear plant right nearby that they did build a higher seawall. We don't even know about that one because there was no disaster. There's all sorts of good projects, but they spent their money on very, very wasteful things because of the political benefits it brought.
Okay, the third hour remains in the quiver, so what's that?
Well, this bridges to nowhere brings up the whole issue of the third hour, which is structural reform. Because again, it's how many things are done to protect vested interests. So the idea of the third hour is what can you do to raise growth? Well, there's two things you can do. You can either raise the labor supply, which, as people get older, is harder to do. So they're saying, well, let's get more older people to work. Let's get more women into the workforce. And they're trying various measures on this. But this is something they've talked about for years and years and years. The trends are going the other way. Their efforts have been meager, have not been successful. The more important thing which they can do is do things which really improve the productivity of each worker. But that's a problem because that really steps on a lot of toes. So here's the problem. You have in Japan a kind of a lifetime system of employment, which is eroding, but it's still there for a large part of the workforce. And it's very difficult for, say, someone who's 40 years old who loses a job at one company to get an equivalent job in another company, especially a competitor in the same industry. So the job itself becomes the social safety net. So because you want to preserve that job, you have to preserve that employer who provides that job. And so an awful lot of companies that should downsize or even die are allowed to hang around, given loans that they really should not get, because this is a form of sort of social security that's being done very, very badly. This is the social safety net. And then you protect various people. So, for example, Japan has four islands. One of them is called Hokkaido, which is in the north. Now, their dairy producers are very, very efficient there. But in the island, the main islands below it, the milk from Hokkaido is hard to get it to Honshu because the dairy producers in Honshu Island, the main island, protect it. And so even within Japan, you have this kind of protectionism. You don't have the kind of flexible market competition that creates a situation of Darwinian survival of the fittest. So it's very difficult for firms to exit the market because they're protected, And that makes it difficult for new firms, fresh firms, to enter the market. This is a fundamental question of the entire structure of the economy. Tinkering around with a few things here or there isn't going to solve it. And I'll give you one example. Here we have Sony and Panasonic and companies like this, which were giants, falling down on the job. Sony used to invent all the new products, the Walkman, and just product after product after product, right? But where's the Sony smartphone? Where's the Sony tablet? Where is this? And the problem is that in Japan, if you take the top 20 electronics manufacturers in Japan, well, all of them came into existence before the end of World War II. The two exceptions are Sony and Casio, which are 1945 and 1946. Now you look at the top American electronics manufacturers. I think 10 of them, I don't remember the exact number, but something like 10 of them were not in the Fortune 500, say, 10 years ago. And six of them didn't even exist 10 years ago. In the United States, it's very easy for a Google and a Netscape and a Facebook and a Staples, whatever, to come into existence and kick out the entrenched incumbents. And that breathes new blood into the economy. That's very difficult in Japan.
So I
think we're getting a lot of talk about reform, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think the third arrow is all talk and no action.
We're just about out of time, but from everything you said, it sounds like you don't think this is going to work.
No, I don't. I think you could have a couple years of euphoria, but not even that, perhaps. That remains to be seen. I think the stock market's happy, but real people's wages are not rising. So, no, I think there's more sizzle and steak to this Abenomics. And it's just a question of how long it takes before that becomes manifest. No, I do not think it's going to work. But people who are trying to sell you stocks in Japan will tell you how great it is.
So it's a good story. One point before we conclude. It's habitual to talk about the Japanese economy in something like a crisis for the last couple of decades, but how much has this affected the day-to-day life of people? Are they suffering?
Yes, but it's first of all, it's not so much crisis, it's slow corrosion as opposed to a cataclysmic crisis like, say, our subprime housing crisis. And you sort of have a share of the pain philosophy. So, for example, if your company is in trouble, instead of laying off 10% of your workforce, you'll cut everybody's wages by 10%. So the pain is shared. So you don't have, you do have homeless, you do have people on welfare, that's growing. But what you get is people who graduate from high school or college and they can't find a good job. So about a third of the workforce is working what are called irregular workers, which is either part-time or temporary. They have lower wages. They don't get the pension benefits. They don't get the unemployment compensation, or they can't afford to send their kids to the best schools. High school is not free in Japan, even public high school. And so it's that kind of grinding down suffering, and people keep voting for change, but they just don't get the change that they voted for. Yeah, people are hurting, but it's, as I said, it's a gradual squeeze more and more and more rather than a sudden shock.
That was Richard Katz, Editor-in-Chief of the Oriental Economist Report. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. My sister-in-law gave birth to a baby girl named Lola on May 21st. You may be surprised to learn that I think she's extremely lovable and cute. So while this song might not be quite age-appropriate, it's very name-appropriate, and it's also one of the great songs of all time. Welcome to the world, Lola.
Cola. She walked up to me and she asked.